It sprang to life selling patent medicines in post-Civil War Atlanta, then grew into the quintessential American corporation selling soft drinks to the world. Zella did, which is why you and I now drink an average of 714 8-ounce servings per year, which led its chief financial officer to say, and I quote, "We've got the best brands in the world. We've got the best, greatest system in the world, and we've got an operating model that generates more cash than any other business in the world." And so today we pause to ask, what is the secret in Coca-Cola's secret formula?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 921st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in London who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Ricochet on the controls and producer Kelly Bayer on the stories. Folks, the Coca-Cola company sprang to life selling patent medicine on the streets of Reconstruction Atlanta, and then grew into the quintessential American corporation selling soft drinks to the world. And it did it all on a secret formula consisting of a few common ingredients. Two of those ingredients were cocaine and caffeine. And I reckon you could say that those two ingredients made Coke the original American energy drink. How the Coca-Cola company grew to be so large and so successful in times that were so tumultuous leads us to wonder about the secret in Coca-Cola's secret formula. Now, according to Wikipedia, the primary ingredients of Coca-Cola syrup include either high fructose corn syrup or sucrose derived from corn sugar, caramel color, caffeine, phosphoric acid, coca extract, lime extract, vanilla, and glycerin. If the ingredients in Coca-Cola are listed for the world to see in Wikipedia, they can't really be the secret in Coca-Cola's secret formula. And so we persist in asking, what is the secret in Coca-Cola's secret formula? Here to help us find an answer, we have Mark Pendergrast, who is the author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, The Definitive History of the Great American Soft Drink and the Company That Makes It. Mark, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. This is the third edition of your For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. So you're the Herman Melville of the soda pop industry, right?
Yes, you mentioned that before we talked. I thought that was humorous, the sort of great white whale of soft drinks.
I guess so. So
he's referring, folks, to the length of the book. I think it's about 500 pages long. When I was writing the book, people asked me whether I could really write a whole book about this soft drink, and I said, well, yeah. So,
well, it is like Herman Melville's Moby Dick in that its detail is absolutely incredible, and I was mentioning to Mark earlier that his book kind of pissed me off because usually I can read a book in a few minutes, but his book is so sticky that whatever page I opened up, it would just draw you in and hold you because there are so many stories. It's really the story of a young America. Mark?
It is, I think. I mean, they chose a review from the New York Observer to put on the front of the book, which said, "A ripping good story of more than a soft drink or a company. This book is about the whole of America. It may be the greatest American story ever." And in a way, in an odd, often funny way, it is.
Now, did Coca-Cola pay you to write this story, or is this something that you did as a...
they did not pay me to write the story. No.
All right. Well, Mark, the Coca-Cola company takes great pride in its secret formula for Coca-Cola, and yet there it is posted on Wikipedia, and by golly, right here in For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, you have the original secret formula. So the secret in Coca-Cola's secret formula is kind of widely known, is it not?
Well, the basic ingredients are known. The glycerin that they have listed in Wikipedia is, may be true now. I have no idea, but it's certainly not true of the original drink. So you have to be careful what you read on Wikipedia, I'd say. But on page 491 of 491 of my book, I have a facsimile for the first time I found since the last edition of the book came out. And it's in the handwriting of Frank Robinson, who is the same guy who wrote out the script for Coca-Cola that everybody knows so well, you know, the logo. He also invented the name Coca-Cola and advertised it and manufactured it. So that is a very early formula for Coke. It may be somewhat modified from when John Pemberton invented it because people kept fiddling with it. And it's not quite the same now as what's in this book. It's got about half the caffeine. It originally used citric acid. You mentioned phosphoric, which is what they've switched to. It used to have cane sugar in the U.S. It now has high fructose corn syrup. And it used to have, as you mentioned, cocaine in it, and they took that out in 1903. But it still has fluid extract of coca leaf in it. It just is decocainized. So it's you mentioned, I do have to correct you. You said it was common ingredients, not common ingredients.
I guess not. Some of them are pretty
rare. In 1886, he was getting these ingredients from Peru. That's where the coca leaf came from. The cola nut, which had the caffeine, came from West Africa. He had some very exotic essential oils in it, such as oil of nutmeg and coriander and lemon and cinnamon and vanilla and neroli, which is a kind of a bitter orange, and they came from all over the world. So it's really quite an international beverage.
And it was all cooked up in the basement, right?
He cooked it up in his laboratory. The company likes to portray that he was this ignorant root doctor who brewed it up in his backyard in a kettle. But in fact, he had quite an elaborate laboratory. He made it, he filtered it anaerobically without oxygen, in other words, through a huge funnel of sand, and took quite a while to filter down and brew. That's certainly not the way they make it now, but that's the way he made it. Also, Pemberton was really a scholar. He knew a lot about all of the ingredients and would tell you at great length about them.
Well, Mark, you know, had it not been for Mrs. Freeman's third grade science lecture one day in which she took a one of the classmates' teeth fell out, initial tooth fell out, and she took it and put it into one of those famous 8-ounce bottles of Coca-Cola, and to the class's amazement, we watched as the tooth fizzed up and kind of disappeared in that bottle of Coca-Cola. And after that, I guess it kind of spoiled my notion of what Coca-Cola was. And so I never did become a big Coke drinker. I do enjoy maybe 3 or so a year. But the average person, 714 servings per year. And if
that's
I'm not
in the
drinking...
US.
Yeah, in the U.S., if I'm not drinking that much, somebody else is drinking a whole lot more. Are we really drinking that much Coca-Cola?
We are. And the Mexicans drink even more, which accounts for the fact that they also have the greatest rate of obesity in the world. It's a problem. But let me just run back a second to this thing about the tooth. Also, they used to drop nails in Coca-Cola to watch them rust away. I think that gave you really a false impression of how evil Coke was. It's acidic, but it's about the same acid level as your stomach is naturally, about the same level as orange juice, which you've probably drunk your share of.
Sure.
The acid is bad for your teeth. If you swirl it around next to your teeth a lot, it will etch the enamel off it. So it's unquestionably not good for your teeth, especially in combination with the sugar. which will get in there and make dental caries. But the real problem is obesity right now. And that, you know, an average, a 12-ounce serving of Coke has about 9 teaspoons, the equivalent of 9 teaspoons of sugar.
We're going to pick up the obesity problem when we come back. We're going to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking for God, Country, and Coca-Cola with Mark Pendergrass. And you do stay tuned. We will be right back after these brief messages. This is the Food Chain.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, just think of it, folks. Every one of us drinks, on average, more than 2 8-ounce servings of Coca-Cola every day. Well, of course, not every one of us. That means some of us drink a lot more than that, and some of us drink less. But on average, 714 servings per year of Coca-Cola. How do they get us to drink so much Coca-Cola? Is it the taste? Is it something in that secret formula that is so refreshing that we just drink so much of it? Or is there something else, some other secret ingredient? Those are the subjects we're playing with today with Mark Pendergrass, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Mark, take us back, if you will, to the days of Reconstruction in Atlanta. The Civil War is over. And what is it like on the streets there in Atlanta?
Well, it was a city that was rising from the ashes. They called it the Phoenix City. And, you know, it had been burned by Sherman during the Civil War. And it became a wildly entrepreneurial place where people were very eager to make lots and lots of money very quickly. And they were very eager to get an infusion of capital from the Yankees. So they tried to distance themselves from the South and say, you know, we don't have any hard feelings. They even invited Sherman back to give a speech. And out of that turmoil, a lot of the money was being made by patent medicine men, because at that time, if you went to a doctor, you probably were worse off than if you had not gone to a doctor. They were giving you mercury, which was a poison, or they were raising big blisters on your body intentionally and breaking them, or they were bleeding.
Wait a minute. They're raising big. How did they do that? What?
They would have a hot bowl. Burning hot bowl they would put upside down on your skin to create a blister. The idea was that when you broke that, it was supposed to make you better, the same way that when they bled you, it was supposed to make you better. So John Pemberton actually studied Thompsonian medicine. There was this guy named Samuel Thompson who very correctly said that the doctors were killing people. His solution was to give them lobelia solutions. Lobelia is an emetic and makes you violently vomit. So they called it heroic medicine, meaning they took drastic measures. So patent medicines were harmless compared to all that stuff.
Yeah, so if you're going to go to a doctor, chances are you're going to get killed, so may as well look for an alternative. And there were these patent medicines. Now, what exactly does it mean when you say patent medicine?
Well, it's kind of a misnomer, because they did not, in fact, patent the ingredients. They all had secret formulas, just like Coca-Cola, which was a patent medicine. They patented the trademark, is what they patented.
Mm-hmm. So the formula wasn't patented, but it was the trademark that was patented.
Yeah, that's okay. What they did. And And they were the ones who really invented modern advertising, because other products, you know, you didn't really have to advertise a sewing machine. It just worked. Or if you did advertise it, it would be for just strictly how much you were selling it for, or the quality of the construction or something like that. Whereas the patent medicines, they really didn't do what they claimed to do, but they made these overblown statements about how it would, you know, cure everything that ailed you. And in Coca-Cola's case, it would cure your headache. It would, it was a hangover cure, and it was supposed to make you more sexually potent also.
And of course, all of the things that sell things, right? Whatever ails you, we got the solution right here in the bottle. You know, it was also, I was kind of amazed to read in your book, it was also a time where we used a lot of morphine and cocaine.
Well, it was all perfectly legal until 1914, when the Harrison Anti-Narcotics Act was passed. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, Pemberton himself was a morphine addict, I discovered, probably because he was wounded in one of the last battles of the Civil War, and he was able to self-medicate easily as a pharmacist. He was particularly interested in cocaine because in the middle of the 1880s, everybody thought that it was this new wonder drug, and that it was not addictive and was not harmful. So at the same time that Pemberton was interested in it, so was Sigmund Freud, and there was a very famous drink called Vin Mariani, Wine of Mariani, made in Paris and also in New York. It was world famous with, you know, alcohol and cocaine in it. And that was drunk and endorsed by President McKinley, by Pope Leo XIII, by Queen Victoria, Thomas Edison, Emile Zola. And that drink is really responsible for Coca-Cola indirectly coming into being. Can I talk about that for a minute?
Sure. Pemberton's first product was a cocaine wine, correct?
Yes, yeah. He made, well, it wasn't his first product, but he made his first popular beverage was called French Wine Coca. He came out with it in 1884, and it was just one of many, many, many Vin Mariani ripoffs. He was imitating it, and he admitted as much in interviews at the time. And what happened was Atlanta voted to go dry in 1885, and it was going to take effect in July of 1886. So Pemberton thought that French wine coca would be unsaleable. So he modified it, took out the wine, and added a lot of sugar and some other interesting ingredients, and that's what Coca-Cola is. And the irony of it is that French wine coca was still able to be sold because he could just call it a medicinal beverage. It wasn't a very strict temperance bill.
And in those times, you know, taking a step or two back, I was really amazed to learn the extent to which cocaine had become part of the food chain, I guess you might say. There's one place where you make mention where sharecroppers used to feed their farmhands cocaine because it was so cheap that it would allow them to feed them less food or something, like 50 cents for a whole week's supply of cocaine.
That's right. And there were many products that had coca leaf or cocaine in them, chewing gum, pills, drinks, you name it. The fact that the farmers were giving the sharecroppers cocaine inexpensively caused a lot of rumors that black men were drinking Coca-Cola and raping white women and killing their bosses, which was not true as far as I know. It was part of the huge racism in the South during the Jim Crow era around the turn of the century. And that's one of the main reasons that Coca-Cola took the cocaine out quietly in 1903 was because of all these rumors.
Well, did Coca-Cola take the cocaine out, or did they take the active ingredient out of cocaine? And
no,
leave the
cocaine
in the Coca-Cola.
cocaine is the active ingredient, and they took it out. What they left in was the rest of the coca leaf. They made part of flavoring was fluid extract of coca leaf. If you look on that page 491 and look at that formula that's in the hand of Frank Robinson, it says F-E coca. That means fluid extract. So they continued to use that, and they still continue to use that to this day in their drink, but they decocainize it. So they take that alkaloid, that active ingredient, out.
And there we are. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about Coca-Cola, a company that's now, $50 billion a year, something like that, Mark?
Don't remember. I'd have to look in my own book.
Something huge, some of money being brought in. And
it's unbelievable.
Now one of the most successful companies in the world, and it's all based on a simple formula that has really not changed that we know of through the years since it was first put together by John Pendergast way back. No, not John Pendergast. That's you.
I'm Pendergast. He's Pemberton.
Pemberton. I was close. Way back there. And when we come back, we're going to pick up how the Coca-Cola company grew itself. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain. We've got the best brands in the world. We've got the greatest system in the world. And we've got an operating model that generates more cash than any other business in the world. Feeling pretty good about their company, Coke Men and Women. How did they go about building such an incredibly successful company? That's the question we're putting on the table today. And we're doing it with none other than Mark Pendergast, the Herman Melville of the soda pop industry, with his book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Mark, how did they go about building this company up and to be such a successful company?
Well, the short one-word answer is advertising. very early on, they realized that they should put the Coca-Cola logo on every conceivable object, particularly ones that people looked at a lot. So they gave away matchbooks that every time you lit something, you would see Coca-Cola, or on the backs of mirrors, or at that time you used blotter paper for your writing, so they would have blotters with Coke on them, rulers. They painted the sides of buildings with Coca-Cola paintings and signs. And they also gave away free drinks, and they would have people sample it to try to get them used to it, because it's sort of an acquired taste. So I told you it was invented in 1886. Pemberton died 2 years afterwards. This guy, Asa Candler, got hold of the drink. But Frank Robinson, who had named it, convinced Candler to do that and went to work for him and advertised it. By 1895, people were writing to him, particularly women, and they were complaining that about the medicinal advertising. They said, I don't want to have to be sick to drink this stuff.
We
like it.
This.
So he started to slew away from that and just emphasized it, that it was delicious and refreshing.
This is kind of a sea change in the company, then, isn't it? It's kind of going from a company that sells patent medicines to something else.
That's right. I mean, it had always been a popular soda fountain drink, not just a medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So they were always trying to do two things at once. But they began to steer away from the medicinal aspects. And also, during the Spanish-American War that started in 1898, the U.S. government was taxing medicines but not soft drinks. And they said, well, look, Coca-Cola is a medicine, so we're going to tax you. And that was another big motivation for them to stop making medicinal claims. The other thing that happened around that same time was two guys came to see Asa Candler and said, we'd like to bottle Coca-Cola. And Candler said, no, I'm not interested in doing that. People have tried it before, and the top blows up, the bottles blow up. It's a not a good drink. I don't trust it.
And,
I don't want to ruin
the
name
bottles,
of my drink.
Why would the bottles be blowing up?
Well, they weren't very well made. And also the stoppers at the time were called Hutchinson stoppers. And if you just jiggled them the wrong way, they would leak. So it was, Candler didn't see any future in it. Just about that time, they were inventing the crimped crown stopper, you know, the little metal that we all grew up with. So the short story is that Candler ended up giving them the bottling rights for free for the entire United States in 1899 in an unbelievably stupid contract that guaranteed them a perpetual right to bottle Coca-Cola and that had no adjustment for the price of the ingredients if they went up.
So and stop right there. Now, Asa Candler, who owned Coca-Cola Company, gave exclusive bottling rights to these guys for nothing.
That's
that
right.
That would carry on in perpetuity forever.
That's right.
And there would be no clause in there for increasing the price of the syrup as the price of the raw materials went up, right?
That's correct. So it's an unbelievably dumb contract.
Yeah.
Well, Candler thought that they would flop. And he told them, he said, I'm not going to put a penny into this. You guys signed this contract. You've got to use my syrup. You can't use anybody else's. So he figured if they succeeded, he'd sell a lot more syrup, which was true. He did. If they flopped, it was no skin off his nose. But it did cause a lot of headaches in later years, several huge lawsuits between the bottlers and the company. And eventually the company ended up buying back the bottling rights for millions and millions of dollars. However, it did produce this incredibly successful franchise bottling system, so that by 1915 or so, you had Coke bottlers being the richest men in town in almost every small town in the United States. And that is what really launched the company, because it democratized the drink. Everybody could get a Coca-Cola anywhere. You didn't have to go to the soda fountain. So that was a big part of, you were asking why, how did it become such a big thing? And it was a series of steps. Candler had a lot to do with it. The bottlers had a lot to do with it. And then the Candler children sold the company out from under the old man in 1919 for $25 million to a consortium of bankers. And then it sort of entered the corporate world. And the son of the main banker was named Robert Woodruff, and he became the president of the company in 1923, and he really was smart, interesting character, probably dyslexic, never read a book in his life, but inherently one of the smartest businessmen going. And he stopped doing any kind of defensive ads for Coke. Up until then, they were saying, you know, we're really good for you, and don't worry about that, those rumors, etc. He rose above all that, and he hired an advertising guy named Archie Lee, who came up with this phrase, the pause that refreshes, that Coca-Cola was this small moment of pleasure in your day, something nice you could do for yourself for only a nickel. And that was very, very successful. So, and then they hired all these painters like N.C. Wyeth and Norman Rockwell and a guy named Haddon Sundblom to paint these absolutely gorgeous Depression-era ads for magazines, showing people enjoying Coca-Cola at different points in their lives. So by the time you came to World War II, Coca-Cola was really embedded in the American psyche as this all-American, nice-for-you drink, whereas it had been terribly controversial in its early years.
So if we can take a step back here and kind of look at the Coke organization, and we have kind of the big Coke, the company that manufactures the syrup, and then we have the little Coke, which are the distributors, independent distributors, all throughout the United States, right? And every town had it. Yeah, every
That's
town
right.
had
you,
it.
You,
go ahead.
They were... Yeah, they were bottlers and distributors. Yeah, they would take the syrup and they would bottle it. So, and they were paying for part of the advertising, too. So, yes, it became, I mean, right now, just to jump to the present, Coca-Cola is the single best distributed product in the world. It is available in every single country.
Okay, good. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Mike Lolson talking Coca-Cola, the Coca-Cola, with Mark Pendergrass, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. We're going to talk about advertising. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain radio program. Mike Lolson, your host today. We're talking with Mark Pendergrass, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Mark, a few years ago, was out in the boondocks outside of Montevideo, Uruguay, driving down a country road, and it seemed like every other fence post had a sign. The first one would say Coca-Cola, and the next sign would say Pepsi-Cola, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola. Here are the two of the world's big companies slugging it out on the fence posts and out in the boondocks of Uruguay. Quite a fight, huh?
Yep, yep. You want the background on how that came to be?
Yes.
Well, Pepsi was just one of many, many imitators of Coca-Cola as Coke became, you know, more and more successful. Pepsi was invented by a guy named Caleb Bradham in New Bern, North Carolina in 1894. But his drink went bankrupt two or three times, and they kept trying to sell it to Coke, and Coke was sort of, you know, said, I'm not interested. Just one of these stupid imitators. They'll go away. And Pepsi only succeeded in the 1930s when a guy got hold of it and decided that he had nothing to lose by bottling it in 12-ounce recycled beer bottles.
Instead
and
of 8
he'd
ounce.
Sell it. Instead of the, well, the at the time, Coca-Cola's bottle was only 6.5 ounces. So this was nearly twice as much, and in his ads, he had a jingle that said, Pepsi-Cola hits the spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot, twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi-Cola is the drink for you. And Coca-Cola refused, in its haughtiness and arrogance, to match them penny for penny and ounce for ounce. So you could get twice as much for a nickel, same price as Coke. And a lot of poor people did that, but it gave Pepsi a low-class image, and it was not a great drink, in fact. It was sweeter but nastier than Coke. In the 50s, a Coca-Cola man named Al Steele defected to Pepsi and brought a lot of marketing wisdom with him, and he was determined to take Pepsi out of the kitchen and into the living room, as he put it, meaning people used to buy Pepsi, and in the kitchen they would surreptitiously pour it into empty Coke bottles and then bring it into the living room and serve it and pretend it was Coca-Cola. So Steele, this was the beginning of television advertising, and he began to portray Pepsi as a more high-class image and to, you know, have it be comparable to Coke. And then they managed to trick the baby boom generation into identifying with Pepsi. You know, it had these really brilliant ads about come alive, you're in the Pepsi generation. And so it began to shed its low-class image. It began to rise on Coke. And finally, Coke did admit that maybe they should try to match them. So they came out with King Size Coke in 1955. And both of them have been getting bigger and bigger servings ever since then. And they've been fighting with each other ever since then.
And somehow, the war continues. What is the essential difference between a Coke and a Pepsi? Not much.
There's not much difference. Pepsi is a little bit sweeter, and Coca-Cola has a little bit more of an acidic snap, a little bit more fizz, maybe.
Bite.
And you know, when Coca-Cola changed the flavor in 1985, very famously, to make New Coke, which was a complete disaster, they tried to make it more like Pepsi. And the people who like Coke just had a complete fit. But
well,
many people never eat this.
It wasn't
I'm sorry,
a complete disaster, though, was it? I mean, when the Coca-Cola folks panicked and changed the formula that had been carrying them forever. It was a complete panic in that the new Coke was a complete flop. But what it did for the old Coke, for the classic Coke, was really reinvigorated the whole product line, did it not?
That's true. It ended up working out very well for them, so well. You know, what happened was, for 3 months, everybody sort of had a meltdown in the United States about this flavor change, and everybody hated New Coke, blah, blah, blah. So when they brought back, finally, classic Coca-Cola, people remembered what it meant to them. Up until then, for 20 years, they've been losing market share to Pepsi, and ever since then, they've been gaining market share. So people thought that this was all a marketing hoax, that the company had intended to do this the whole time. Well, I can tell you, they did not. But it worked out very well for them. It was a massive history lesson for them.
So it was one of the few places in history where the unintended consequences of an action actually proved much better than the intended consequences, probably. And thus,
it's
the
true. The
Coca-Cola folks who had panicked because Pepsi-Cola was catching up with them and surpassing them, and people said Pepsi tastes better. So they panic and they change the Coca-Cola formula, the formula that had carried them for 100 years almost, and changed it to the new Coke. And the new Coke, it just pissed off everybody, did it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you should read the letters that are in the book. These were letters that people wrote to the company in April of 1985 when they changed the flavor, and a few months thereafter. And it sounds like somebody killed a member of their family. I mean, they were that upset. It sounded like they had killed God. And then when they brought back the formula, you had these letters basically like the second coming of Christ, saying, you know, bless you, you have restored my faith in humanity, and et cetera. It was just unbelievable that they did this over a soft drink that's mostly sugar water.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to ask Mark Pendergrass the big question, which is, what is the secret in Coca-Cola's secret formula? Do stay tuned. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Coca-Cola Company has us drinking 714 servings of Coca-Cola every year. How do they do it? What is the secret in the Coca-Cola Company's secret formula? Is it the ingredients in Coca-Cola? Is it something else? Mark Pendergrass, in talking with Coca-Cola Company spokesperson, said, I'd like to put the formula in my book. And the spokesperson said, well, go ahead, put it in your book. Why did he say that, Mark?
Well, I was asking him what would happen if I did, because I knew that I had found the formula and was going to. I didn't really want to hurt the company. And he said, well, let's pretend I've got it right here. Here, you go ahead, put it in. And I said, well, okay. And he said, now what's going to happen? I said, well, maybe somebody will make a fake Coca-Cola. And he said, okay, what are they going to call it? How are they going to advertise it? How are they going to distribute it? What are they going to charge for it? He said, you see what I'm driving at? Why would anybody go out of their way to buy a fake Coca-Cola, not called Coca-Cola, that they'd have to charge more for? We have the world's best distribution system. It would be hard to find theirs. And what would be the point? When they can get it anywhere in the world, they can get the real thing. And he had a good point. So the formula itself, even though they love to make a big mystique out of it, and they have now moved it to their museum called the World of Coca-Cola in Atlanta, that's not the point. The point really is what it means to people. In fact, there were people, when the New Coke thing that we talked about came out in 1985, who never tasted New Coke. It wasn't that they didn't like it. It was that they didn't like the idea of it. So it's the idea of what Coca-Cola is that means so much to people. And that, basically, they've positioned it so that it means world peace and happiness and youth and energy and good times and everything that we all want.
And all of that through advertising.
That's right. And also through placing it really is a part of many people's, you know, memories of their first dates, of time they shared with their parents. Of it's embedded in childhood.
So when you say, you know, the secret of Coca-Cola's secret formula, you're really talking about over 150 years of positioning a product so that product becomes part of our lives, a part of America.
Not quite that long. It's more like 127 or so. But, yeah, it's become a part of our lives. And, you know, there was one guy in the book who told me, who said, you know, this product is destined to outlast the United States. It's more self-correcting than the Roman Empire. And it's certainly, you know, 80% of its profit comes now from outside the United States. And it's not just Coca-Cola anymore. They offer 3,500 different drinks all around the world. So they're highly diversified in terms of beverages.
And they have enough money to buy pretty much anything that they see as a legitimate contender to people's taste buds, correct?
Yeah, they're not so good at coming up with new drinks themselves. So, for instance, they bought Glaceau, which makes vitamin water, for $4.1 billion a few years ago. $4.1 billion for, again, sugar water, a different kind of sugar water.
Mark Pendergrass, we're out of time. How do people get in touch with you?
My website. It's markpendergrass.com. You can write to me directly from there.
Thank you very much for joining us, Mark, and thank you all for tuning in. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.